The rock hits me on the head, and the sore lump feels very intimate, like a personal message saying, Doug, don't do anything so stupid again. Message received. But of course, it's not a personal message. Gravity works the same way in Chicago and Helsinki and Buenos Aires and Tokyo as it does right here. Follows the same principles on the moon, Jupiter, across the galaxy, across the universe. It's a universal law. And to think that it has somehow given me a personal message is just narcissistic confusion. But I'm not helpless. If I understand how gravity works, I'm going to throw a rock at a 45 degree angle and it doesn't land on my head. And I'm happier. There are lots and lots of universal laws, laws of nature, that set the parameters for our lives. We live and work and play within them. Some of them, like gravity, are very easy to understand, and we see them objectively, and don't really take them personally. I've never seen somebody fall off a porch and then shake their fist in the sky and say, gravity, stop picking on me. Somehow with gravity, we get it. But some laws are very subtle and very complex, and so we may not understand how they operate, and in not understanding, we take them personally. For example, much more common than rocks dropping on my head are thoughts dropping into my mind uninvited. And there are universal laws that just govern how all that operates. But if I don't understand them, I tend to see those thoughts as rogues who have come in and invaded my space. See them very personally. But I began to understand all this a little more clearly on a retreat out in the desert about 2 years ago. I had had, one afternoon I had this very long, peaceful sitting. And then I went outside to do some walking meditation. And thoughts began to drop in. And I wished them away, and they kept coming. I used all my clever meditation techniques to get rid of them, and they kept coming. Muttered to myself, why are you always picking on me? They kept coming. And then this image arose in my mind of the brain, human brain. 100 billion neurons. I have no idea what 100 million is. I think it's a lot. 100 billion neurons. Some of those neurons have thousands of dendrites connected together, this vast neural network. And throughout my life, I've thought about certain things in certain ways, repeatedly, and that just reinforces certain circuits go through. That repetition just strengthens those circuits. It's how the brain stores memories. So I go outside, you know, do walking meditation, and the sun is out, and there are birds, and a little bit of breeze puts a little extra stimulation, and as that flows through that neural network, it lights up those circuits that have been reinforced. So I saw all of this, and I chuckled a little bit. Even my thoughts are not personal. They just come out of biological laws that put these circuits and things together. And so if I get frustrated at this, that just puts more energy into the network and lights them up even more. And if I try hard to get rid of them, that just puts more stress into the network and they light up even more. So thoughts flow through the mind the way waves flow over a pond. You know this metaphor? So if we jump in the pond and try to slap all the waves down, it just creates more disturbance. But if we just sit back and relax, the waves gradually run out of energy and the pond just returns to its own natural quiet. If we see this, then we're not helpless. Rather than trying to force the thoughts out, I can view these thoughts with a lot of kindness, a lot of acceptance. Ah, they're old friend. You know, just relax, let them be. So I'm not putting more energy into the network. And then the network just begins to quiet down. And the mind actually returns to what is a very natural quiet. So there are lots, there are many, many other laws that govern how the mind, heart operate. Ananda, who was, Diane mentioned him last week, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant during the last 20 years of his ministry. He was also his first cousin. He had this phenomenal memory. And in the Mahadandana Sutta, Ananda said to the Buddha, "It's amazing, it's astounding how deep these laws are, how deep their appearance. And yet, to me, they seem as clear can be. These laws about how the mind operates." "Don't say that, Ananda," the Buddha replied. "Don't say that. Deep are these laws, and deep their appearance. It's because of not understanding and penetrating this Dharma, how these things work, that this generation is like a tangled skein, a knotted ball of string, like matted rushes and reeds that does not go beyond deprivation, woe, and ill fortune." So to help us untangle the skeins and the balls of string, knotted balls of string in our mind, the Buddha laid out a map of how these natural laws work. The map is called Patthakasamuppada, the laws of dependent origination. Laws of dependent origination. The map doesn't include all the laws of the universe. Right? It doesn't say anything about quasars or electromagnetism or the second law of thermodynamics. The Buddha really had a very narrow focus of concern. He was concerned about suffering and well-being and how to relieve it. So the laws, the essential ones that are related to that, are included on this map. The map includes the entirety of his teaching. He said once, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma, sees the whole of his teaching. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination." Some of you are familiar with some of his other teachings, I'm sure. The Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are embedded within each phase of dependent origination. It's right in there. The three characteristics. One of the things the Buddha is famous for, how everything is impermanent, is unsatisfying, is unsatisfactory, and is impersonal. So you can understand that as a general principle, and that's just fine. But if you really understand dependent origination, you'll see those three characteristics just in the nitty-gritty, all over the place in everyday life. In the suttas, there's this word that appears a lot, wisdom, panya. When the Buddha used the word wisdom, he meant specifically understanding dependent origination. So when you see that in the suttas, that's what he's talking about. He said that if someone who understands dependent origination, they're wise. If you don't, you're not wise, even though you might be clever about a lot of other things. The word ignorance, ajiva, that means taking things personally. The beginning of the Eightfold Path, wise view, is not taking things personally. When you see dependent origination, you see how unpersonal things are. So, if we are sincere about true freedom, then it's really important to explore dependent origination. And even if, you know, awakening that seems just really remote and esoteric, if you just want a little piece, a little well-being, dependent origination can be very helpful. If we see it clearly, we are less tempted to rail against gravity, or complain about a little bit of chatter in the mind. If we really understand in dependent origination how things work, then we just work and play within those laws. Rather than rail against gravity, we just stop throwing rocks straight up in the air and stop kvetching about a few neurosynapses firing. So it's very important. And when we see it, dependent origination, we see how it's impersonal, how things always were. And when we see it's impersonal, we see that these things are not a problem. Okay, so dependent origination can help us unravel all these things. But it's important to know right off the top that dependent origination is a map. It is a map. It's not the territory. I love to hike up in the High Sierras. I have for years. And I always take a map with me. Although in recent years, sometimes the map is an image on the GPS. And, you know, look at the map and it has all these contour lines and a little dotted line where my trail is and the labels of mountain peaks and rivers and usually tells me where north is too. But when I'm out there walking in the High Sierras, I don't see any contour lines. There's no dotted lines along the trail. There's no big labels printed out there on the side of the mountain. There's just, you know, the bugs and the lichen and the scent of the redwoods and the spaciousness of the sky and the clear, cool air and those huge rock formations and all the things that actually make that country inspiring. But you won't find those on the map. So dependent origination is, the map itself is pretty dull. It's about as interesting as a hammer. So you can get a very good, polished understanding of dependent origination, and it's not going to actually help you much in your life. So the map is just a tool. It's a guide. It's something to be used and applied. And as we use it, it helps us cultivate well-being and avoid a certain amount of suffering. So tonight, we're going to continue this exploration of dependent origination. And what I would like to do is have us look at ways that it can help us navigate the pain and discomfort in our lives and cultivate that well-being at the same time. So what I'd like to do is, first of all, I want to give you just a real simple kind of everyday example of dependent origination. And then we'll look a little bit, just a broad overview of the map itself, and use that to look back at this example. Okay. And then the third thing I'd like to do is to look at how dependent origination arises in meditation practice and work with that. And then if I'm not too long-winded and there's time at the end, I'll read you another example, a little story from my own life that kind of weaves it all together. And please stop me as we go along. I'm going to be flying really quickly on it. And so stop me at any point if we want to go into more detail. But first, let me start with an example. So I had this guy come to me and he said, I'm going to try to meditate, but I can't, because I just can't control my thoughts. Ever hear that? ever said that. And I could see there was a little bit of frustration and discouragement in the corners of his eyes. So I said to him, I said, you know, nobody can. Nobody can control their thoughts. In fact, it's usually counterproductive to even try. It just hypes them up more. So I suggested, why don't you go back and rather than control your thoughts, just when they come up, just relax. Just relax and see what happens. And he blushed a little bit and he said, you know, I have this habit of trying to control all kinds of things in my life. And I said, well, you know, it's good that you see that because there are a lot of people who don't know it. But what you can do is that when you sit down to meditate, thoughts come up, don't control them, and if the urge to control them comes up, don't indulge it, don't stop it, you know, let it run, but just relax. Just relax and see what happens. Rather than get involved in that or fighting against it, let it run and just release it and relax, let it be, and see what happens. So it came back to me a little bit later and he said, you know, I tried it, you know, and it worked. But what happened when I relaxed the control is there was some fear that came up. And he said, you know, the fear has always been there, but I think I just really pushed it away. And so I told him, I said, you know, that's a good insight to have. It's a good insight to have. And I said, so now go back, and if the fear comes up, rather than running with it or fighting it, just let it be, just release it and relax. And then see what happens. And just see what happens. It really didn't surprise me, you know, that fear came up. In my experience, you know, when there is control, there's almost always fear underneath it. If there wasn't fear, why would you want to control anything? But still, I was glad that he could see it directly, because that's the nature of insight. If you just figure it out in your mind, it's not as helpful, but if he could see that in his own life, that was really much more helpful. So, I haven't heard back, but let's continue with this. Okay? So, if he relaxes the fear, what do you think is likely to show up next?
Love?
Hurt.
Sadness.
Anxiety. Hurt, sadness, anxiety, love. I hope we get there. But as fear relaxes, love is not what drives the fear. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably hurt, anxiety, something in that range. Other thing that can show up underneath there is anger. You've been frightened because fear runs down the body. As it starts to turn around, anger will come up. But underneath anger, there's always hurt as well. So, should we keep going? So, if he sits a little bit with that, and the hurt comes up, and just relaxes the hurt, what do you think will happen? And by hurt, what I actually mean is suffering. You know, sensations come up. Sensations don't always lead to suffering. So what is it that turns sensations into suffering? So as it relaxes the hurt, what might show up underneath that? What is it that turns sensation into
the narrative about it?
Narrative?
Aversion.
Non-acceptance.
Aversion, non-acceptance?
Clinging.
Yeah. So all those, I would put those in the sort of broad category of resistance. So when you were a kid and had a loose tooth, creates that sharp sensation in there. So what did you do with it?
Wiggle it.
Yeah. Run around, you know, wiggle with my tongue. So it was this great, this sharp sensation. But it was great because that meant the tooth fairy was coming and I'm becoming a big boy and all that. So there's sharp sensation. But if I fought it, if I resisted it, it would have been terrible. So resistance, fighting what is really crucial to hurt and suffering. So, we keep going? So if he relaxes the resistance, what do you think would show up next? Pardon?
Oh, I just said neutrality.
Neutrality?
Tranquility.
Tranquility?
Equanimity.
Pardon?
Equanimity.
Yeah. What else?
Could turn around back into the anger and
turn around back into the anger. Yeah, dependent origination, you know, think of it as flowing in one direction, it does have these back eddies. So if, you know, if there's hurt and you relax the resistance to it, what you tend to see is just this flow of sensations. You missed it because it was a little too simple. You were going a little bit further. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant. So, can you see how this investigation is going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whatever comes up, we're just looking to relax what that is, soften it, and so we can see what is going on subtly underneath it. Most of the states that come up in us are triggered by something subtler underneath it. And this is especially true if you have recurrent thoughts or recurrent patterns. You know, it can't seem like, you know, they just grab you by the throat. There's probably something subtler underneath it that's driving all that. So the bad news is that the things that are triggering it are subtle, and so they're harder to see. But the good news is they are subtler, so if you can see them, they're easier to release and relax. So this is how dependent origination works. We're always looking for, not so much looking for, but opening up to see something that is subtler going on underneath something. And it's not free association. In a free association, you go from a thought to a thought to a memory to an impression to an image to another thought, and sort of bouncing around all over the place. But with dependent origination, we're always looking for what may be subtler underneath it, so that can be released and relaxed. Okay. Are you with me? Got questions or things that come up? I'm about to switch gears here. We're going to look at the classical map of dependent origination and compare.
So, is there, I'm going to put this crudely because I can't think how to say it, but is there an end to that? Is there a bottom point?
Yeah, there is a bottom point. So what you're doing with all this as you're relaxing is you're releasing tension. And when that goes deep enough, there are the things people are talking about, tranquility, equanimity. They are very natural states that are with us all the time, but they don't draw any attention because they're quiet. And so as those quiet down, those begin to surface. And those actually become more obvious. And then when the mind and heart actually get quiet enough, then everything stops and you slip into nibbana. But that's another long story. But that's actually what happens. Dan?
Yeah, I follow the process and everything. I don't have it nailed down perfectly. But I understand.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get at the general principle here.
Yeah, I got the general. The thing that stops me is just the terminology, dependent origination. It doesn't seem to have any relationship to what you described in my mind. I mean,
exactly.
It's not dependent, and there's nothing original.
We'll actually get to that. And I would say, just in general about the suttas, that's what I'm really emphasizing. It's a map, and don't get hung up on the map, because translating the stuff from Pali into English. I think I shared with you some of those examples of translation problems of when Pepsi went into China. Remember that? Pepsi went into China, they took their slogan, come alive with the Pepsi generation, and they translated it into Chinese, and it came out, Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the dead. Or I've got to say this other one. That's my favorite one was Purdue Chicken. When they went into Mexico, they had this slogan, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. So they translated it into Spanish, and it came out, it takes an aroused man to make a chicken affectionate. So we're talking about soda pop and fried chicken. Now, when you start talking about stuff that is subtle, as these quiet states of mind, and then you try to translate them from, you get, and what a lot of scholars do is they try to get all the nuances in. So you get these long phrases like laws of dependent origination that covers just this, you know, the short little phrase. And it gets really, really cumbersome. So I think what I'll do is I'll just go ahead and I'll walk through some of the traditional links. And we'll just kind of look at them in kind of normal human English.
Okay. So I'll just relax and release.
Relax and release is in there. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as tranquilized body formations. Okay. You know, it's like, whoa, you know. Sounds like trying to medicate a rock. But no, what it really means is relax and release. Okay. So some of the language in the text, as you're saying, is really awkward and demystifying. And so I gave you, on the sheet, so my translation of these terms, as well as some other ones, as well as original Pali. So when you're having trouble sleeping at night, you can start memorizing that natural. So what I want to do is begin this flow about halfway through it, at the point at which the flow of dependent origination emerges into ordinary experience as raw sensation. And in dependent origination, this is called contact. Contact just means raw sensation. So you hear a sound, and you don't know whether it's a distance, traffic in the distance or peepers in the pond. You haven't even thought about that. At first, there's just the sound itself before there's any thought about it. Or you feel warmth, and before you even think about where it's coming from, there's just a raw sensation. And so in this map, that's called contact. The raw sensation might be pleasant, it might be unpleasant, or it might be somewhere in between. That's called feeling tone. Vedana is usually translated as feeling, but it's really confusing because they're not talking about emotion. So I use the term feeling tone just to kind of make the difference. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. If it's pleasant, we have this tendency to want to, you know, grab hold of it or move towards it. If it's unpleasant, we tend to want to push it away or get rid of it or move away from it ourselves. And if it's neither pleasant or pleasant, actually, we tend to just ignore it. So there's moving towards, moving away, and ignoring. Collectively, the Pali term for that is tanha. And it's translated as craving, but it's a terrible translation because craving, to me, always sounds like a mad dog. But it's just referring to this tendency to want to move towards or grab or push away or space out. And tanha can be very gentle. Just wondering about, oh, that was a nice vacation. You know, that you feel there's just a little bit. Tanha is always experienced as tension.
As what?
Tension. Tension or tightness. It's always at least a subtle amount of it. So the up to this point, there are no words and there's no concepts. There's raw sensation, feeling tone, a tensing. If the tension is not released and relaxed, then what happens is the mind begins to shrink wrap around that experience. It gives it a label. It starts to cloak it in words. This is called clinging. And clinging is always experienced as a thought. It might be a visual, it might be an image, or it might be a word thought, but it's always a thought. So what that thought does is, so, raw sensation, feeling tone, tana. You know my favorite translation for tana? It's the Three Stooges. In Pali, there are these terms, lobha, dosa, moha. You familiar with those? Yeah. So lobha is the one that moves towards, dosa is the one that pushes away, the moha is the one that gets confused or spaces out. Doesn't that sound like Larry Curly and Moe? So, I'll try to stay on track. So there's raw sensation, there's feeling tone, there's tana, the Three Stooges, there's clinging. It's always experienced as thought, and that thought will trigger a bunch of other thoughts, or ideas, or opinions, or storylines, or thought constructs that usually play out according to our habitual tendencies, our conditioning. So the next one is called habitual tendencies. That's what I call it. We can go back, the traditional labeling is really confused, but in your practice in daily life, and what you're looking inside, that's how that phase looks like. You can look and say, oh, there's this old pattern of mine, or there's this thought of mine. If that is not released and relaxed, what that does is it begins to push us into some kind of action. We begin to act on it. And it may be a physical act, it may be a verbal act, you say something, or it may be a mental act. But we feel this push, you know, to do something or say something or to decide something. And if those are not relaxed, we end up in suffering. Okay. So raw sensation, feeling tone, tana, clinging, some kind of action, I call that birth of action. Because it's just the beginning of it. When you go to honk the horn, or when you first want to say, once the words are out, it's all over. So it's really noticing right at the beginning, suffering. So, comments? Questions? Yeah.
I just want to the raw sensation can come from the outside, but it can also be, I'll be lying in bed and I'll have a memory. Or
that's right.
I'll have had an event during the day. There's nothing happening outside at all.
Right.
It's just hitting me in the gut or wherever, and that is a sensation.
It is a sensation.
It's an internal.
And as many of you know, in the Buddhist psychology, the mind is considered oftentimes a sensory organ that picks up thoughts. So there are those thoughts, those train of thoughts that spin out, but there are the ones that just kind of arise.
But they become a bodily sensation.
Right.
It's kind of, that's where sort of a lot of the thought, but also the raw sensation of the body.
Yeah. Yeah, good. And sometimes it moves very quickly. There's a sensation, it's unpleasant, and there's aversion. Could happen very quickly.
So would that be like number six, contact?
Well, what she was talking about is contact, feeling, tone, and the craving. It was there. Oh. Tana. Oh. Three Stooges show up. Oh, I don't like that. Other comments? Questions? Okay.
Well, could you just follow what she said along this line? Because sometimes those physiological are so strong. And it's hard to imagine really softening. Would you just cover that?
That's a great question. And when we get to the meditation, we'll actually go in a little more detail with that, and I'll talk about that. But I would say, in general, this is what we're stuck with, is that as awareness gets stronger, at first we notice it, but the awareness may not be actually strong enough yet to relax it. So when I'm talking about recognizing, releasing, relaxing, it's actually an invitation. Because there's all kinds of tension, because the mind, you know, can tense around it too. So it's just paying attention to that. And it's an invitation, you know, to the body to soften. But you don't want to try to force it to soften. That becomes counterproductive. But if you do that, so even if it's tight and you can't relax it, if there's the invitation to the mind is actually quite compliant. And it will learn, oh, this is okay, you know, and so over time, it'll gradually become able to do that. We can't always do it initially. If we could, we'd all be enlightened.
So what do you do to relax
it? You do what you can. You just soften, you notice it. And it's a good question. I just don't get... So there is the awareness that's looking at this tension. And if you can't relax the tension, what you do is see if you can look at it with a clear, relaxed awareness. Oh, wow, I'm really in a knot. You know, you may not be able to relax that, as opposed to saying, oh my gosh, this is terrible, I'm gonna die, you know, if you can just see objectively that there's something here that's a little overwhelming.
Breathe.
Pardon?
I say breathe.
Breathe, there are lots of those techniques that a lot of you know. You can breathe, you can soften it. The place I always start is to look at the quality of awareness that's looking at it. But good, yes, there's lots of things. Yoga, you know, there's all kinds of things that you recognize that you can work with this.
Yeah, one thing that I discovered about myself is that some of these things have been habituated in since I was a teenager.
Right.
And I'm almost 72 now, and they are really hard work.
Yes.
I mean, even though I can see them now, like you were calling, those things light up, and you just got to keep observing and make whatever patient effort you can make.
Right.
I mean, years and years of habituation, thinking that it was going to make you happy, and it's really...
And I think it's real helpful, as you say, to see that as neural wiring, because it does make it a little less personal, you know. And so, yeah, you know, if it took you, many, many decades, as all of us have done, to build these things up, you know, the neural wiring is not going to disappear overnight. And if you fight it, it just strengthens it. It's like, you know, trying not to think about a white horse, you know. It's like, it just doesn't work. But if you can say, ah, yeah, of course, given what I've done, given what's happened to me, of course this is going to be here. Ah, okay. And find ways to be with it that's not fighting it. Fred.
Yeah, Doug. I'm finding myself hopelessly awash in what seemed to me to be conflicting and incongruent and sporadically ordered concepts. And I've really been struggling with this for a couple of weeks now. I've been looking at your book, I'm looking at your chart, and I remember, I'm just a neophyte of this stuff, but I remember several lectures on, I think it was the aggregates, you know, the basic sensation,
right.
A feeling, tone, perception, concepts, and awareness. And I'm,
you remembered it. Wow, great.
I have my moments, yes. And I'm looking at your charts here, and I'm looking at one of your book, and I'm seeing the same terms here. I'm seeing feeling tone, I'm seeing contact, which is, I guess, is your sensation.
Right.
I'm seeing six senses, but I'm seeing contact over here on another, says English interpretation, it says perception, and then I'm looking over here, and way up in out of water is consciousness and formulations, and I can't put them all together. Where are they going? The aggregates make sense to me, but the spots and pieces of what you're saying makes sense, but the whole package doesn't seem to fit together for me.
Just worry about the last half of it. Don't worry about the.
What is the last half of it?
It starts with sensation and goes up to suffering. What happens is the mind
goes sensation. Let's see, here we are.
Contact, number six.
Okay, number six. Contact, sensation, okay, and it goes that way. all right. But the other things seem kind of important.
dependent origination is a map of the whole thing. Formations, it's a terrible translation, sankhara, are extraordinarily subtle. And you can't see them with ordinary awareness. As the mind gets quiet and very still, you can begin to perceive those. But don't worry about it.
Oh, I am.
Six are the word. Six are the word. Yeah, we can talk about it. I mean, originally I was going to unpack all of those, but I realized that was going to take, you know, half an hour or 40 minutes.
Yeah, okay, I'll leave you alone now.
And what is actually most useful in our everyday life is those top six. And believe me, if you get all those working, the others will reveal themselves. So what I want to do is let's go back through this example of this guy that came in trying to control his thoughts, and just take a moment and see if we can map it against this. Okay. So, oh, wait a minute, something else. I wrote this little note in here of. Maybe we ought to sing It Ain't Necessarily So. You know that from Porgy and Bess? The stories you're liable to hear in the Bible, they ain't necessarily so. The stories we're used to hear in the suttas, they ain't necessarily so. And the Buddha would agree. Okay? So at face value, it looks like things flow from contact, you know, raw sensation, to feeling tone, on up. It looks like it flows inevitably into suffering. But just a little bit of reflection says that's not always true. You know, you can find ice cream pleasant without wanting more. I mean, we usually do, but it's possible. You know, you can throw rocks up in the air without them falling on your head. So there's a tendency for things to go that way, but fortunately it's not ordained. And the Buddha agreed with it. However, and this is where we start applying this stuff. The reverse flow is true. If there is suffering, it was always preceded by some birth of action. If there's some birth of action, there were always habitual tendencies that triggered it. There are habitual tendencies, there was always some clinging before that. This clinging there. So what the Buddha talked about, this was not about where suffering comes from, it was about how to relieve suffering. Okay? So if there's suffering, the first thing to look at is what are the actions that are creating that? And can you, if there's actions, what are the habits that get you moving into that? So it's easier to learn the map going what I would call downstream from ignorance or from contact to suffering. But when you apply it, you go upstream. Start with the suffering and work back up there. So let's go back to the example. So this guy showed up complaining about not being able, well, he wasn't complaining, but saying, you know, he just couldn't control his thoughts. So where was the suffering in that?
Frustration.
Yeah. There was a frustration, you could see it in his eyes. There was a frustration.
Wanting it to be different.
So there's a frustration. We're actually a little ahead of the game. So there's a frustration. And what is it that gave rise to that frustration?
Trying to control the thoughts.
He was trying to control his thoughts. So that was the action. What is it that got him to try to control his thoughts?
Fear.
Habituation. Yeah. There's these habitual patterns that thought that this was the way to have a good life is to actually get in control of this stuff. And so what is it that triggered those habitual patterns?
Attachment.
Yeah, that's where the fear, the things you mentioned before. Okay, so can you see how that works? So, do I want to move to meditation practice? How do you use that? Okay. So again, it's always, and all this, as you can see in that, it's always the language in the suttas was, if this, sometimes it's called a remainderless fading away. If this stops, then this ceases, okay? And this lays us out. So how does this come into meditation? Let me just say a couple things about meditation in general and make sure we're all on the same page. In all the meditation practices that I know, they all of them will have what I will just call a primary object. Okay, this is when everything's, nothing particular is going on, this is where you let your attention rest. When the mind wanders, it's what you return to. So for 30 years, my primary object was the breath. And some Zen practitioners will use a koan. Transcendental meditation uses a mantra. So lots of different objects you can use. In the last half dozen years or so, I have used uplifted states, kindness, compassion, and sending that out to return to. Okay. So here's your primary object, and your awareness is resting on it, and things are just groovy. You're sitting there meditating. Then there's this thought. Snarly, that's what it is. Why did he say that? We had such a nice conversation going, and then he said, why don't you just lighten up a little? How could he say, oops? I was supposed to be meditating. Uh-oh. So you all know that place? So you get lost in this. So what do? 6R. Recognize where the attention has gone. Release it. Relax. Smile. And then you have this little, the mind is not quite as tight as it was when you first recognized that thought storm. And so you take this slightly elevated awareness and you bring it back to your object of meditation. It could be sending out kindness, it could be the breath, it could be whatever you use, but you bring it back. Snarly, why was he saying that? Oh, there it goes again. And so you're back out there. Recognize, release, release. So keep, but you know, every time it does that, the mind gets just a little bit of tension is released, the mind gets a little clearer, and so you're seeing this whole pattern more clearly, and so you're sitting there and the word snarly comes up. Snarky. Whatever it was. And you recognize it and release it and relax and smile before the whole storyline. Snarky. Recognize, release, relax. Snarky has a huge charge in it, right? You can feel the tension in it. So then what happens is you just notice that tension and you recognize, release, relax, smile, and return even before the word emerges. And so as you're doing this, a byproduct of this is that your attention will be resting on with the object of meditation much, much longer. And when you get caught, you don't stay caught as long. And so the mind is getting quieter. It's getting quieter. And then there's just that little bit of tension. Recognize, release, relax. And then you'll be sitting there, and it'll be very peaceful, and you just notice the mind begins to wobble. You know, it was very peaceful, and just kind of starts to go a little bit. You haven't seen anything else, but you actually see that. To recognize, release, relax, smile. And then it's sitting there and the mind just sort of vibrates just a little. 6R it. And then it gets totally quiet. And you slip into nirvana.
Just that easy.
A few other stages in there, but that's basically it.
What is the difference between releasing and relaxing?
Releasing is releasing the whatever the distraction was.
And how
you're thinking about that. So it's you release your grip on it, you let it be, The synonym for release is just let it be. Relax is what you do with yourself. You relax any tension that's in there.
So release is sort of in your mind and relax is in your body?
That's part of it. That's part of it. But the relax is also in the mind and in the emotions as well. Yes.
Sometimes we're instructed to investigate it, and wouldn't that capture it?
Yeah, so investigation is really tricky. But do you notice what's happening in this? You're actually seeing dependent origination. Right? The first whole thought pattern, you know? Those are the habitual tendencies. You know, snarky is the clinging. The tension in there is the Tanaha, the Three Stooges. You know, in yourself, you know that. So you're actually seeing dependent origination. And again, what the Buddha said, when he was talking about investigation, he wasn't talking about investigating everything. He was really talking about seeing this cause and effect relationship, how everything that arises has an origin. That's where it comes from. Everything arises dependent upon something else, and to see those relationships. That's where the wisdom comes from. That's what the freedom comes from. Whether you really understand why your mother kept your roller skates, you know, when you're, you know, we can get fascinated by that, but that's actually not as important. So there's a lot of insight that comes out of it, but it's a little bit of a byproduct. You're not actually going after it. So there's a little bit of investigation might come in if you are really stuck. You know, there's something you keep on going back, you know, to the same old pattern, and it doesn't soften, it doesn't unwind. Then there's probably something subtler underneath it that you're missing, and that may, at times, be worthwhile to spend just a little bit of extra time, actually with a recognized step. You know, just recognize a little more deeply what's going on. All right, go for it, Fred.
I can't help but ask the question. Okay, you've had these snarky scenarios. So here we are with our object and our meditation, right, and we're kind of quieting down. And then you think, Jesus, last night had a beautiful sunset. God, that was so beautiful. And you know,
you feel the habitual.
Can
you feel the habitual tendency and the concepts and all that stuff running out? And can you feel the kind of the yearning?
Well, is that bad?
The question is it disturbing? None of this is bad. None of this is bad.
Think you can hold it forever. Well, you know.
None of this is actually bad. Things are bad. Things are a distraction if you're trying to develop one-pointed awareness. But if what you are interested in is learning to see how this thing operates, if you can see how that operates, and in this practice you aren't getting rid of that thought, you let it be. You release it. You relax, that you see if there's any tension within that, and you'll find that, oh, that was wonderful. There's a little bit of that. And so you just let that soften. And I hate to say it, but what happens if that was driven by tension, if you let the tension soften, it will run out of gas and evaporate. I'll read you an example of it in a little bit. Maybe I won't. We'll see.
If something that you're feeling that you've been six-R-ing and it keeps coming up, and you could say generally like guilt, and then you probably ought to put some time in thinking about that, but you know, because it keeps coming back, would it be valuable to just wait till you're done meditating and think about it as you're going through your day?
Well, okay, that's a great question. So
you've recognized.
Yeah, but it's, you want to recognize what's going on. And as you recognize the guilt, what you'll find is guilt is not just one tiny little point, but there's like all kinds of other feelings and stuff around it. Mm-hmm. And so as you recognize, and particularly as you release and relax and smile and the mind gets brighter and clearer, it will see more and more of those subtleties until gradually the guilt itself will start to unravel and may reveal something else underneath.
So it's better to keep it in the meditation practice, or is it you not investigate it in your head without the going through the path?
So thoughts really get traction in habitual tendencies. And so if you are analyzing it and thinking about it, you're actually staying stuck at that place.
Okay.
And what's driving all those thoughts are actually subtler. So you can, famously do psychoanalysis for 20 years. A good analyst, that may not happen. But, you can understand this up the wazoo, But it's actually seeing the subtler things that are causing
it. Feeling it instead of thinking it.
Okay.
That's good.
So we're almost up to 9 o'clock. Do you want to hear this other example that kind of weaves a lot of it together? And then I'd be interested in other reflections. A couple of things, for example, there's no wheel in this. The flow is in one direction. So they have Tibetan Buddhism started in the 11th century, 1600 years afterwards. So there's a lot of things that are thrown on a dependent origination that are not in the original teaching. There are no links. Buddha didn't use that term. Links make it sound like they are discrete elements that are chained together, but it's really more like a flow. It's like a river where it changes its texture. But we can talk about that. Let me read this. I shared a little bit of this. I was just back from a retreat. We had a panel here last spring, and I talked a little about this, but I wrote it up as a blog in a little more detail. And I wasn't thinking about dependent origination at all. And so what you'll see in this, because if you listen for it, you'll see various places and how there's a tendency when this appears in our life, we may get stuck in one place and we may move through other phases more quickly. So you'll see how this. I awoke around 12:30 in the morning, rolled over and began to slide back into slumber. A thought drifted lightly through my mind. He's an emotional coward. He referred to a man with whom I'd had a difficult relationship, and I had handled it with equanimity and empathy and compassion. I had been a paragon of kind maturity. The phrase emotional coward captured the essence of what I found difficult, and the angry vapors seeping out of the phrase brought me back from the edge of sleep. Send him an email. Tell me he's an emotional coward, I thought. I no longer felt like a paragon of compassion. I'll stick a finger in his eye. Beneath my spiritual sensibilities was a tantrum that I had been quietly pushing aside. I might have been able to subdue the ire, but when I try to fight the truth, I always lose sooner or later. The truth was, I was angry. The genie was out of the bottle, and I had no desire to push it back in. Now I was thoroughly awake. So I got out of bed, wrapped myself up in a blanket, and sat down to meditate. It began with the refuges and the precepts and those two aspirations we did. We seek to observe the mind heart without preference. I seek clarity and acceptance. I'm not trying to join this clarity and acceptance. My object of meditation was equanimity, sending it out in all directions. After a short while, it began to thin out into what's called clear mind. Very peaceful. Then a thought erupted. I want to tell him this, 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 and that. I didn't really want to poke him in the eye, but a good tongue lashing would feel satisfying. I recognized the flush of anger. Meditation is a purification process. Another whole thing. It's a purification process. As the mind heart quiets down, toxins rush to the surface. It's healing. So I just let the feelings be. I released them in the sense of not trying to hold on to them or push them away, but I gave them plenty of space to romp around inside. At the same time, I relaxed the tension in them. It felt like relaxing into the anger. not away from, but relaxing into the anger. I smiled slightly and sent out a little equanimity. This would be a better way to say it, I thought. That'll get him. An hour later, waves of righteousness continued to rise through me, followed by moments of quiet, followed by another wave. I just tried to stay out of the way and let them do their thing. They'd throw me off balance for a moment. I'd feel it, release it, relax into it, and return to equanimity, only to be thrown against the rocks by another wave. I had hoped this would subside. It kept going. I felt discouraged. I recognized that discouragement is just another impersonal energy. Released it, let it be, softened into it, and smiled. 15 minutes later, I noticed the thoughts no longer had any specific content. They still reverberated like buffaloes stampeding across the plains. But I couldn't make out individual animals anymore. They weren't specific thoughts, just thundering hooves. Then the rumbling ceased. There was still aversion without content. I continued to recognize what was going on in the mind heart, released it, relaxed into it, smiled softly, and sent out peacefulness. Then it was gone. There was only a pervading quiet and ease. I vaguely remembered I'd been upset about something, but it took effort to recall what the fuss was all about. Oh yes, that guy. Compassion welled up for his suffering that made him behave so poorly. There was nothing I could do about it, so I let it drift away like the last clouds fading into a clear sky. There was a slight luminosity in the back of my mind. I thought it peculiar that I found it easier to recognize upset than this quiet glow. So I relaxed into it. In a while I winked out. When I came back, mind heart was soft, quietly joyful, and expansive. And my body was fatigued. It was 2:30 in the morning. I crawled back into bed and slid into sleep.
I mean, this may be my weird way of thinking, but I think, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Paul Simon song, Lips Sliding Away. The closer I get to my destination, the more you see lips sliding away. And I don't know.
Yeah. Are we ready to close? I know. Send me an email. I'll send it to you. I know some people have to get up early in the morning. It's rude having to make a living sometimes. So let's pause for just a minute. And I would invite you, if as you sit here quietly, if you recognize any tension in your mind, in your emotions, in your body, just let it be. Just relax into it. And if there is just quiet in there, send that out. If there's equanimity or peace, just send that out, all beings around the planet. We are all so dearly tied together in the sea of relationships. So we'll close the evening by just sending out through this network of relationships. May all beings have ease. May all beings know how impersonal their life really is. May all beings have contentment. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings have sweet dreams. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your practice that nurtures all of us. Thank you for being here.